As far back as I can remember, I always wanted to be a gangster.
You all right?
My leg is broken, a bounce coming through.
Welcome once again to Irish Noir.
Don't ever take sides with anyone against the family again.
And this, the last in our four-part journey through the world of Irish crime fiction.
People lose teeth talking like that. If you want to hang around, you'll be polite.
So far, we've looked at the birth of crime fiction and its various subgenres, the hard-boiled sleuths of the early 20th century, and of course our own particular brand of crime fiction which emerged in the wake of the Civil War and the Troubles. And why, we wonder, did it take Irish writers so long to really give it a go? And we also marvelled at the boom in Irish crime fiction fuelled by our experience of wealth, austerity and white-collar crime. But in this final episode of the series, we're back in the present day, with an eye to the future. Where can Irish crime writing go from here? Does the crime genre really appeal to Irish readers? Or should our own writers perhaps set their stories further afield, in places which might give them more scope in terms of story, and with it perhaps a bigger international readership? We'll also look at the huge success of Scandinavian crime fiction and ask whether the current wave of Emerald Noir writers could do what our Nordic brothers and sisters have done so well, take on the crime fiction world en masse. Joining me are three highly regarded practitioners, John Connolly, Arlene Hunt, and Alex Barkley. John Connolly, if I could go to you first. You don't particularly believe that the Golden Age, or indeed the noir crime genre, sits particularly well in Ireland.
I think it's a difficult one to pull off for us. We don't necessarily have that tradition in our writing. It took a long time for us to get any kind of hold in the genre at all. And I think importing wholesale those kind of traditions of the US noir novel don't necessarily work terribly well for us. And I often think, you know, a lot of the notions we have about the crime fiction that comes from particular countries is often tied up with our images of it. So even people who've never been to America have a kind of conception of what that society is like, and therefore have a familiarity with the way it uses crime. When we look at British society, quite often the kind of British crime fiction that sells in America or sells abroad has to do with an almost stereotypical view of England. You know, it's an England of bobbies and bicycles. That's the stuff that sells. They don't particularly want to read hard-boiled novels set in Newcastle. That's not what sells terribly, terribly well. And I sometimes think if Irish crime fiction is going to grow, perhaps there is a way of using people's image of our society.
But given that nearly every writer we have spoken to in this series cites you as the influence, certainly one of them, but one of the main influences on them. You know, and given what most of them are writing about, and you're just after saying we can't really do it.
Well, no, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that it's quite difficult, and we are at a kind of gestation phase. It's, you know, a lot of crime fiction has been written very, very quickly in this country. We haven't had time to establish traditions, and it's clear that some of them are going to be dead ends. It's the nature of crime fiction. People are going to explore alleyways and think, well, actually, that one didn't quite work for us and we need to step back again. The only reason that I'm an influence is because I think a bit like perhaps the first generation of female, not people who are writing women's contemporary fiction. And for a long time, Irish fiction was more admired than read. You know, we won prizes and you could throw a stone and hit a poet or a playwright. But the extent to which that had transferred to a mass audience is open to debate. And then in Ireland, we had the moment when Maeve Binchy came on the scene and you had books like Light a Penny Candle. And suddenly British publishers began looking at Irish writing in a different way and began thinking, hang on a minute, not only do these people maybe win awards, but we can maybe sell them as well. And large numbers of people will want to read them. And I suppose I was fortunate with that I began writing crime fiction at a time when there weren't that many crime writers writing it, and I did well. And that was enough again to make British publishers look at the Irish market and think, actually, we can take in other writers if this guy can do it.
Those ideas of those books that take on a kind of a gritty realism about Ireland, is that gritty realism what we should be doing? What suits us better? What we ought to be doing, even?
I'm not sure fiction of any kind has any particular duty to or obligation to reality. That's not the point of fiction. Fiction is essentially a prism. Fiction refracts experience and allows us to look at it in a slightly different way.
I think the best thing that Irish crime writers could do would probably be to stop reading newspapers. That we shouldn't get ourselves so caught up with this notion that we're obliged to examine our society, that we're somehow the people holding a magnifying glass up to, you know, the after effects of the property crash, or, you know, ghost estates, or, you know, the banking crisis. Those things aren't actually in themselves very, very interesting. They're only interesting in the fact that they fracture society. And crime fiction likes dark places. Crime fiction likes the shadows. But whether as writers we should be obliged to take reality by the hand and say, well, listen, I'm going to lead you into my office here. Now, why don't you explain the situation to me? And then I will put it into a form in crime fiction that ordinary people will be able to understand, and it passes for entertainment too. We don't have that obligation. I think that's a dead end for us. I remember about a year ago, Fintan O'Toole in the Irish Times had written a piece where he was kind of lauding crime fiction, Irish crime fiction, because he said it was the only fiction that was kind of tackling the nature of Irish society at the moment. You know, there are two things here. Firstly, the reason why writers write books and the reason why readers read them are two very different things. Nobody going through Dublin Airport is looking at the crime fiction section and thinking, well, I'm going to read Patricia Cornwell's latest piece of social commentary. You know, that's not why we read it. And perhaps we read it when we do read it, if there are larger themes there, they're to do with compassion and justice and the disparity between law and justice in particular, because crime fiction has always been very interested in that. Do we have to tie it so literally to a period and a place and a time and a particular set of social problems that are ours? Because actually that limits your readership, and it also limits your readership abroad.
Alex, let me bring you in on what John's saying. Leaving aside obligation, you do want your books to sell. You want your books to be widely read. And there is this one theory that we do want to read about ourselves. And there's this other theory that the last thing we want to read about is some lowlife in our own hometown.
Yeah, and I was of that opinion at the start. That wasn't what interested me. And when I started, I knew that I was always going to set my books in the States. For now, that's what I'm doing. I don't know how it's going to unfold after that. But what I will say is, say, a TV show like Love Hate, that has really captured people, and that is something that I thought was a genre I wouldn't be interested in, and I love it. Any sense of obligation for me would turn me off, and that's always been the way I've been about anything. You know, the bit that gets lost is there's a writer there who's spending a year working on this, who wants to write something that interests them as well, and hope that the readers feel the same way.
And Arlene, I'm bringing you both in briefly at this point, but you have confined yourself to Irish settings for the most part until recently. Were you thinking hard about that where the novel should be set and maybe perhaps move it somewhere else?
No, it was purely to do with geography, because the story that I had for the latest novel, The Chosen, centred around a pretty broad hunting scene, and in terms of sheer geography, it's impossible for this guy to operate in the terrain that we have in this countryside. You know, we're too small an island. You can't go anywhere. I mean, you can travel down to the most remote parts of West Clare and you'll come across German hitchhikers. You know, it's just really difficult to find a vast enough space for someone to operate and feel that they can get away with whatever they need to get away with in order to do what they want to do without stumbling across somebody else. Whereas if you go across the water to like the States and go to somewhere like where I did the last time, which is the North Carolina, Tennessee border, I mean, you can be lost there for weeks at a time and never come across another human being. So it was really important just to set that particular book in that particular area for that particular story.
So that was for practical reasons in the sense, and creative reasons too, obviously. But you don't have any misgivings about Ireland's potential as a location for crime fiction and this type of crime fiction?
No, because we've changed from being a sort of rural nation to an urban nation to a certain extent. You know, we've changed so much from a country which can be staggered by a murder. You know, back in the 1970s when I was growing up, if someone was killed, it was a big thing. It was a nationwide news. People spoke about it in the local shops. People spoke about it, you know, outside the church on a Sunday. You know, it was always a big thing. Where now murder is more commonplace and crime is more commonplace, and we're all connected up now via the internet, via Twitter, via social media, by everything else. So for me, in my generation, it's very easy to sort of include Ireland in everything that's going on because we're all so connected up.
Given all that then, John, why do you think the Irish crime fiction took off the way it did in the 90s?
I think it was to do with a generation of writers who had probably come up reading not just the classic American crime fiction of the 30s, 40s, 50s, but what I would think of as the kind of later boom that came around in the 80s and 90s. So we're talking about people like Patricia Cornwell, George Pelecanos, Michael Connelly. I looked at these people and thought, actually, perhaps, you know, what Irish writers are expected to write about and the nature of Irish writing isn't writ in stone, and that we can take some of these influences and use them. Now, my reaction was that I felt that it was not appropriate for me to do that. And I felt at the time, had I begun writing an Irish crime novel, then it would have been a bad novel.
But in terms of that success, John, at that period, there were, as has already been said, there were a lot of changes in society. Things were happening rapidly. Economic changes, social changes, cultural changes, they're happening all around us. That must have fed into that.
Oh, I think that's certainly true. You know, and I think it suddenly became clear that there were aspects of Irish society that could now be tackled through crime fiction in a way that they probably wouldn't have been able to do before. You know, I think a book like John Banville's or Benjamin Black's Christian Falls is really quite interesting, because that's a book that is ostensibly set in the past, but it touches upon events that were really only had really only come into the public forum here in the last 10, 15, 20 years, which were to do with the Magdalen laundries, which to do with the way that we treated women in this country for a long time. So what Banville is doing there is using crime fiction to write about the present through the prism of the past. I find that interesting.
We're going to hear from John Banville, Benjamin Black, later on in the programme. And John, before I ask you further about your own writing, we're going to hear a short reading from your first novel, Every Dead Thing. And here, your main character, Charlie Parker, comes home to his worst nightmare.
I called Susan's name once, then again louder this time. Already the drunken haze was clearing and I had my foot on the first step of the stairs to the bedrooms, when I heard the back door bang against the sink unit in the kitchen. Instinctively, I reached for my Colt DE, but it lay upstairs on my desk. Upstairs, where I had discarded it before facing Susan in another chapter in the story of our dying marriage. I cursed myself then. Later it would come to symbolize all of my failure, all of my regrets. I moved cautiously towards the kitchen, the tips of my fingers glancing against the cold wall on my left. The kitchen door was almost closed, and I edged it open slowly with my hand. Susie, I called as I stepped into the kitchen. My foot slid gently on something sticky and wet. I looked down, and I was in hell.
And Every Dead Thing is published by Hodder. John Connolly, your work is obviously steeped in the American background, American style, and all of that. Why did you do that? Why did you focus on America?
You know, if you grew up in a small town, you can have two responses to it. The first is that you want to stay in the small town and get married and work in the small town and raise your kids there and die there. And the other response is that you want to get away as far away from that small town as quickly as possible, as soon as you can leave it and do something else. And I felt a little bit of that pressure, that expectation of what an Irish writer should be and of what an Irish writer should write about. And because we weren't really doing, you know, there was a handful of writers writing crime fiction here in Ireland. But it felt, genre fiction felt like a way of escaping that, because we really don't have very much time for genre fiction, and we certainly didn't have any time for crime fiction. It was almost like I felt it was the worst thing I could do. You know, for a long time, our genre fiction was fantasy fiction. That was what we did. And, you know, the great Gothic novelists of the 19th century were all Anglo-Irish writers. But it seemed to me that post-independence, we forget what a young country we are sometimes, post-independence societies go through a process of self-examination. That's what they do. And literature and art becomes one of those means of self-examination. So a lot of what I felt was a lot of Irish writing looked inwards. It was about trying to figure out, what are we? What nation are we going to become? You know, and that's an interesting and a very, very important part of a nation's development. And it seemed to me that that was still ongoing. And yet I did not want to be part of that discourse.
Arlene, in your case, again, you've written the American thing. How did you get the hang of it as such? Because when you do go, you know, writing anything American, did you have doubts as to whether or not you should be in this territory, that, you know, really I shouldn't be here trying this, I should be at home writing what I know, write what you know, they always say.
Yeah, they say a lot of things. I don't take too much notice what other people say about it. I write what I want. You know, the story comes first, and then thereafter you'll fill in the surrounding area and the characters and everything else. This wasn't a book that would have worked here in Ireland. It just wouldn't have, because the opening of the book is a high school shooting, and we're not really... It's not really part of our social makeup in schools. We don't really have a gun culture per se.
How did you get started, Arlene, in crime fiction?
Just, it was like an organic, I don't want to say evolution, but an organic procedure for me. I was a big crime reader always. I mean, it was a running joke in the family that I spent half my life with my nose in a book. And that's the sort of genre, as I got a little bit older, that I enjoyed to read most. And it wasn't really that much of a stretch then to write. Funnily enough, there was no part of me that didn't ever think I wouldn't get published. And I say this because I teach quite a bit, and I say it to, I can see the fear in creative writing classes. I can see the fear in pupils sitting there. They think, well, not only will I have to write the book, will I ever get published? Will I, oh my God, how will I do this? And what if somebody says no? I never had that fear in my 20s. I just used to tell people, oh, I'm writing a book and it's going to be published. That was it. I never had any sort of question mark over it. I just was completely fearless.
Who were you reading, Arlene? Who were your role models?
My earlier books would definitely have been, I always say Joseph Wambaugh was a huge eye-opener for me, because I went from reading Enid Blyton and the Secret Seven books and James Herriot books and anything like that. All of a sudden, the first time I read Joseph Wambaugh's pretty influential 1970s, The Choir Boys, it was like just getting an electric shock, because he wrote of his time, and he was an LA police officer himself, and the language he used in that book, you just wouldn't get away with it today. You wouldn't be allowed. It was racist, it was sexist, it was boorish, it was violent. And I reread it, you know, a couple of years after that, and I've reread it again since, and I always take something away from that book.
Well, Arlene, we want to have a listen now to a reading from your novel Undertow. You're also going to put your fingers in your ears, I noticed, during this.
I'm just going to wait till I go pinker.
This introduces one of the main characters, Mink.
For as long as he could remember, Anthony Dunlop had been called Mink. Never Tony or Anto or any other abbreviation of his Christian name. Just Mink. By the time he was old enough to question this peculiarity, the name had stuck. And its origins were lost in the mists of time, although his older sister had once informed him it was because he was a rat bastard, only sneakier. And like dogs that came to resemble their owners, eventually Mink grew to fit his moniker. At barely 5'4", he was hardly a remarkable specimen of raw masculinity. He was slight and dainty, prone to giggling, which did nothing to diffuse the rumours that he was as bent as a 6-pound note. Mink, of course, knew about the rumours, but cared little for what other people thought. Gay, straight, into barnyard animals, it was all the same to Mink. The truth was that he was straight by design, but asexual by choice. Frankly, he found the whole idea of sex messy and slightly distasteful.
And Undertow is published by Hachette. Alex, it is true, isn't it? I mean, we're dancing on the head of a pin a bit in this series because it's about Irish noir, but really it's about all the normal tenets of fiction that we really should be focusing on. It's about characters and stories. How did you get started, Alex?
In a similar kind of way, I think I was 28 when I started writing Dark House, and I thought it was going to be a screenplay, and it was completely out of the blue. It came to me as the opening of a movie, as a police chase through New York. And I just had this idea, ran it by my family, who were really supportive, and it was over dinner, we were having a laugh. The next morning I got up Sunday morning and started writing it and wrote the first scene. And I had worked as a journalist and a copywriter before, so the writing thing was always there. But I still never thought I will write a book or I will have a book published. And the publishing part of it wasn't really at the forefront of my mind either. I still think that it's an unusual job to say that I do, because I feel like when I started, I didn't tell anybody that I was writing either. I felt like it was like saying I'm going to LA to be an actress. It just didn't have the ring of a very real job.
Why doesn't it feel right?
Because it's not work in a way. I call it work and I say I have to go to work or I have a lot on in work, but it just doesn't feel that way. I mean, you're getting up in the morning, sitting down, drinking loads of coffee, eating cake and biscuits and making up stories. It's a wonderful thing to do.
Okay, so let's have a listen to a reading from your most recent crime novel, Blood Loss. This is actually the opening passage about the derelict Kennington Asylum.
It was an imprisonment twice over. Minds capped at first by insanity were captured a second time by Kennington Asylum for the Insane. Built in 1904, it was a dignified structure on a salvaged tract of Denver City parkland. Mental wellness forged from red bricks and green grass. In appearance, it stood for its promises. But until it became the hollow shell it is today, it never truly reflected them. In contrast, the grounds were overrun, choked by nature untended, as if the twisted roots of madness, ignored for over a century, were finally unbound. People had been sent to Kennington to be healed, but when they were captured a third time by a camera's lens, they stood in doomed herds, their faces blank, their brains looted. It was clear that the asylum was not a pit stop on a journey to wellness. It was the end point of a descent. Their clothes were soiled, their limbs atrophied, their bodies swept into corners like dirt, like something to be thrown away.
And Blood Loss is published by HarperCollins. So, Alex, you have two distinct crime series on the go at the moment.
Yeah, well, I started with Joe Lucchese and wrote two novels with him, and now I've moved on to Ren Bryce, and the last four are with her, and I've started a children's fantasy series. Again, it's the same thing. I don't want to feel limited by anything, even by the genre. If someone had come up to me at 15 and said, you'll write crime fiction, I wouldn't have believed that. But maybe if someone came up to me when I was 7 and said I'd write a fantasy novel, I'd be very, very happy. I might have believed it a bit more.
OK, we're going to talk a little bit more about the question of using contemporary influences, that's news stories and the national feeling of unease and so on, in crime fiction itself. But before that, let's hear from one Irish writer who is taking on the crime genre with a certain relish and indeed success. John Banville writes atmospheric crime stories under his nom de plume Benjamin Black. His Quirk series, set in the 1950s, has an acute eye to the dark secrets of what we now know about the kind of country Ireland really was at the time. Here he is on Black, Banville, and writing with two very distinct fictional voices.
There are no Hercule Poirot's, there are no Sherlock Holmes's. And that's how things are. You know, most crimes don't get solved. Those that do get solved, you know, very little justice is meted out. This is life. And when I started writing these Quirk books, that was a pact I made with myself, that I would make them as, if not as realistic as possible, then as plausible as possible. And I think that is the essence of noir fiction, because it's all about secrets. The criminal has a secret, of course, but usually all the people around the criminal have secrets as well, as we all have. Crime fiction is driven by plot, character, dialogue. These are things that Banville doesn't care about at all. Real crime writers get furious when I say things like this, but this is just how it is. Banville and Black are completely different writers. One is not necessarily better than the other, or worse than the other. They're just entirely different. You can't compare them. It's apples and oranges. Benjamin Black is quite humble. He has no pretensions. And he rather despises Banville for his pretensions. I look on the Quirk books as well-made, well-carpentered. I want them to be, you know, like a well-made piece of furniture, beautifully constructed, beautifully polished. And I'm quite proud of them. I'm not proud of the Banville books because they're all such abject failures. But the Quirk books, I do feel it, I do take pride in.
Afterwards, Quirk had tried to put it all back together in his mind like a jigsaw puzzle. It would never be complete. The bits he remembered most clearly were the least significant, such as the smell of the drenched laurel behind the railings in the square, a street lamp's rain-pocked reflection in a puddle, the cold, greasy feel of the area steps under his desperately scrambling fingers. There was throughout a sense of deep embarrassment. That must have been the reason he did not cry out for help. Embarrassment and a kind of incredulity. Such things did not happen, yet this one did, and he had the wounds to prove it.
I don't think he's a very admirable character. He's certainly not a very nice character, but he is interesting. I have a certain sympathy for him. He is driven by the darkness in his own past. He's an orphan. He doesn't know where he came from, although he has some troubling suspicions as to what his origins might be. And this, I think, is what drives him. This hunger to know people's secrets, to know where people come from, what they've done in the past. And he has his own, if not crimes, certainly very serious misdemeanors in his own past. I'd put it this way, he's not morally admirable, but I think that he is, in a curious way, spiritually admirable. There's no point in going to what's now called literary fiction, because literary fiction is always about the past. In crime fiction, I suppose you could write about the present. And maybe my black books, even though they're set in the 1950s, maybe they are, almost accidentally as it were, maybe they are some kind of commentary on present-day realities of Irish life. They're telling us very dark things. Literary Ireland has produced giants or failures. We seem to have no middle ground. We seem to have no middle brow tradition. We aim to be the greatest or nothing. And I suspect that crime writing was part of that. You know, we're too good for it. You know, I want to be James Joyce. I want to be Oscar Wilde. I want to be William Butler Yeats. I don't want to be Dorothy L. Sayers.
John Banville there, and the latest Benjamin Black novel is called Holy Orders and is published by Mantle. John Connolly, let's move to the present. It's probably a bit worn out now having this discussion, is it, about, you know, pre-Celtic Tiger, post-Celtic Tiger. But in relation to crime fiction, it does seem to have a real relevance.
There does seem to be a fascination for some Irish crime writers in exploring the aftermath of the boom, I think. There's a larger problem here as well. By and large, most local crime fiction is going to be supported by a small number of, a certain percentage of local readers. Okay, so in Scandinavia, crime writers there were able to write about Scandinavia and support themselves without needing English translations. Okay, somebody like Lisa Marklund, the Swedish writer, would sell 250,000 copies in hardback in Sweden in Swedish. She didn't need that market. I've just come back from France, and I'm always astonished by just how many French writers I've never heard of, because they're not translated, but their local market for crime fiction is big enough to support them. In Ireland, we're not used to seeing our society necessarily examined through the prism of crime fiction. We're kind of in the first generation, not just of writers, but of readers. And it will take a while for us to build up any kind of percentage within the market of people who are going to read Irish crime fiction on a regular basis. But that is not going to be enough to sustain Irish crime writers. Okay, we're in a bind because our market is so small. For Irish crime fiction to continue, for it to persist, for it to remain successful, it does need to bring in readers from outside. Now, how you go about doing that is the issue. But I suspect the answer is not necessarily raking over the coals of our recent history.
So where do we go from here then, John, if we don't write about ourselves, if you know what I mean? I know there's more to it than that.
Writing about ourselves is not the issue. It is the way in which we choose to write about ourselves. We have, you know, crime fiction is always about the past. Crime fiction, it's a bit like science fiction is always about the present. It seems to be set in the future, but it isn't. Crime fiction, to some degree, is always tied up with the past, with notions of past crimes, with the hidden sins. We're a society that has past crimes and hidden sins coming out of our ears. That idea of secrecy, that idea of concealment, is integral to crime fiction. So it doesn't necessarily have to be tied up with empty buildings on the docks. It doesn't have to be tied up with estates down in Longford and Kildare. There are ways that we can write about ourselves through crime fiction that are actually universal, that would more or less guarantee our appeal beyond these shores. And that's what we need to do. I think we need to think differently about the kind of crime fiction that we're going to write.
Arlene, where does Irish crime fiction go from here? Because there is that danger of with the best intentions of the world, somehow becoming very parochial again, you know, and just talking about our own problems.
I don't actually know where it goes because, you know, when you're trying to get an accumulation of Irish writers and what they're writing about at any given moment, it's like herding cats. You know, everyone seems to have such variation in theme and variation in what they're writing about. I suspect we'll just keep writing about what interests us as individuals more so than we'll follow any particular trend or any, you know, particular style or, you know, what might be popular at the moment across the water. I think we'll just go with what we like and what we're interested in and what resonates with us and what speaks to us.
Alex, how well disposed do you think the Irish readership is to Irish crime fiction?
I think it takes Irish readers a while to get used to the idea of Irish writers writing crime fiction, because I do think the history has been there for us, including myself, to read American crime fiction, and that would have been my thing. I did read some English crime fiction too, but it was mainly American. And also maybe there's a question of whether or not Alex Barkley can convincingly write a US-based novel. So there's maybe that wariness is there as well. But I think the more of us there are, maybe there would be a greater acceptance there of, okay, there is a movement there. There are more Irish crime writers. We are all legitimately writing in the voices of our chosen settings. And it's just a question, I think, of getting used to that.
Okay, well, look, let's just move out of the studio one more time and try and figure out, at least help us figure out, what it is that makes the genre such a success with readers. And what about that theory that it appeals more to women than to men? We sent Rona Tarrant out to find some answers.
You feel like you're in it.
Mr. Grandison's residence. Oh, hello there.
And you feel like any loud noise or anything, like, let's say, I don't know, the doorbell rings or your phone goes off, you might actually screech because you're in the middle of the story.
I'm all alone here. Thursday, you know.
You're standing there with the characters, watching it happen. When reality comes back, you're breathless because you've forgotten that you were even in your living room. You thought you were in the story.
Hello, Rosalind. Hello?
That's how it should make you feel. That's how it should happen.
The operator, your party's hung up. Shall I try them again?
I think it gives you a feeling of apprehension. So you're on edge, therefore you're quite aware of what's coming.
Oh, the plot pace, definitely. And the twists and turns of a puzzle. The intricacy, if it's good.
My name is Ronan Quinn. I'm a bookseller here at Dubray Books on Grafton Street. I would say more women. I'd say it could be 70-30, even more, from what I can see at the till. Without trying to pigeonhole it too much, I would say it's definitely women from their late 30s upwards.
I think we spend a lot of our time, you know, living within rules and regulations. So even getting out of that and recognising that there is bad in life and perhaps identifying with the bad guy every now and again isn't necessarily a bad thing.
I remember reading The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, and you see him solve a crime or find the villain. And then he goes through the whole rigmarole of telling you how he did it. And all the clues and all the inconsistencies were there from the beginning, but you don't pick up on them.
Perhaps in contrast to a lot of other genres, The hero's area of strength when it comes to crime fiction is absolutely nothing to do with physical power. It's all mental acuity or psychological insight. And women are every bit as well equipped as men in that.
We look for empathy, and we're more emotional creatures anyway. And I think as a result of that, we try to find a reason to everything the villain is doing. Why did he kill this person? Why is he behaving like this? Why did the hero go down this path to try and figure him out? We have to understand.
The urge to understand predator or see through their eyes has a strong element, I think, of self-protection to it as well. And the maybe fantasy that we can escape the crosshairs through being better.
I think it is still true of modern crime fiction, and it's an unfortunate truth that very often women are the victim of crime, perhaps more so than men. Although they do turn around and give as good as they get, and if anyone's read Gone Girl, they'll certainly understand what I'm saying.
It's an idle flirtation, one drink too many.
I was warned against the siren call of adventure. I should never have stopped to talk with you.
You mean you're afraid of me?
Linwood Barclay's stories, I mean, he's one of my favourites and he does always keep me guessing. But his female characters, they tend to be a little bit more pathetic. I think he sees them as easy victims. But you do have sometimes female characters who are vindictive, manipulative, deceitful. They are there. And they are more interesting. If you go back even to Sherlock Holmes again, I mean, he's got Irene Adler, and she's the only woman who ever bested Sherlock Holmes, and he's supposed to be the best.
I can't watch any crime, any true crime documentaries or anything like that, but the fiction I can get lost in, because I like them gory.
Sound ridiculous about it, but there could be some sort of thrill with reading this thing of, oh, this could happen, or, oh, look, there's a bloodstained hammer on the cover of that book. There must be some sort of rampaging killer.
There's a certain voyeuristic element to, I think, most crime reading as well, apart from the puzzle solving, in that we all have a certain eagerness to see justice brought about, or vengeance enacted, or once in a while for the wrongdoers to really get it in the neck.
I love the fact that at the end they get the bad guy. It always makes you feel a little bit better about our own police and our own Gardaí trying to fight crime. And I think because life is so chaotic, that trying to make sense out of the chaos, which is invariably what all the detectives, fictional or otherwise, are doing throughout solving a crime, that you do get that sense of order out of chaos.
Rona Tarrant reporting there. Arlene, tell me about the readers you've met at events. What is their response? And it keeps coming up in this programme, in this series, that women readers tend to dominate. Is that the case in your experience?
Yes, it is actually. At most book launches I've been to, or if I'm doing reading somewhere, it's usually the audience is made up of 98% women normally. It was interesting, last year myself and Declan Burke went down the country to do the Peregrine readings, and Tremor was really interesting. It was packed. It was the Tremor Library. Tremor Library is quite a small library, but they have a huge number of reading groups in it, which is fantastic for a small library. And on the night in question, we went down and we read, but I think there was two guys in the audience and the rest were all strictly female. The piece that I read was a particularly violent scene where a guy needs to find information, and to get the information he needs, he grabs a small child out of a playpen and dangles said child out the window. And it's a particularly rough scene. He's a real piece of work. When I finished doing the reading, the women all clapped, and the sole guy who, one of the two men that were there, gave out stink about it. He was saying, oh, you know, now you're glamorising violence, and how could you write stuff like this? And then he looked around the audience and go, and you lot, how could you all sit here and listen to him giggling and smiling? And he was really outraged about it. But I think one of the things that women get out of crime fiction, and it's my own opinion, so I'm not saying it's set in stone, but there's a certain amount of comeuppance in crime fiction. And it's one of the things that a lot of women like. You know, you give a sense of power back to people, because maybe someone is a piece of work. Maybe some guys are going around being cock of the walk and, you know, intimidating people and being threatening and being frightening and doing all the things that they think they can get away with. But inevitably, at the end of the book, those guys will come a cropper. And there's something very finely balanced about that. And there's something that people like to read and see in it. Now, it doesn't have to be a pat ending, but the idea that these guys won't get away with it and that they will suffer the consequences, I think women relate to that because women aren't always in power. So for them to see a character regain power to a certain extent in crime fiction, you know, it's quite a satisfying feeling.
But of course, Alex, before it gets to that point in a piece of crime fiction, women readers are reading about women going through what are actually their worst fears, I would imagine. Women go through terrible torment and torture in crime fiction, yeah, and yet women love to read it.
I don't have a problem reading violent scenes. I don't have a problem writing them, but my books have gotten less violent as they've gone along. I had a lot of violence in Dark House, but now it's almost hinted at more than anything. I think women like to explore all areas of crime fiction. And I think we put ourselves in the position of the victim, whether we like it or not. And that sense of fear is a very safe type of fear. So you get to experience that without being in any real danger yourself. And it's an adrenaline rush in one sense. And yes, there's a sense of justice then at the end.
Arlene, you wanted to come in there.
I think that in my own view, it's a confidence issue as a writer, though, as well, that you allow your audience, you have more faith in your audience and your readers as you get a little bit older. And as you write more, you hope to get better in each book. You don't necessarily write the violent scene as paint it by numbers, so to speak. You paint it in a broader stroke because you know that the reader can fill in what it is that you're trying to say to them. And actually, one of the most powerful things you can do in crime fiction is allow the reader bring their own imagination into it, because we don't know what is in the heart of every reader, but we know that they have fears and they can be very frightening. And if you allow them fill in the blanks, so to speak, of what it could be the most despicable thing for them, they'll create something much more frightening than you could possibly ever write. And it's an interesting balance then to give them enough of the tools, so to speak, so that they can create their own monster.
And John, in your case, because, I mean, when you appeared on the scene, first of all, the violence was spectacular. I mean, I was thinking, how did he think that up? I mean, how? I mean, I was worried.
Is that a complaint?
but why have you started to write, as you say, less violent scenes and less violence?
In part, there's the realization that you can do it more subtly. But also, it's a cheapjack way of sustaining tension. It's a cheapjack way of making readers turn the pages. Patterson, his novels are routinely do it. You know, there's a massive body count because actually it's just much easier to toss a body on the page every so often. Raymond Chandler used to say that when he ran out of inspiration, he would just have somebody walk into a room with a gun. It's a kind of variation on that. I think, and here is where I can hear the minds going off around me, I think men are perhaps much more conscious of how they use violence against women than female writers are. I think female writers will inflict things upon their characters that no male writer would do, because the male writer would feel that he is open to accusations of misogyny. And the worst scenes of violence that I've read in crime fiction in the last decade have all been written by women, not by men.
What do you think of that, Arlene? I think he's right, actually, but there we are.
I think women can approach violence quite unflinchingly, and I think that kind of makes people go, oh, okay, what the hell's going on in their heads? Because I think, by and large, women understand the fears that women understand, so to speak. So if you're a female writer, you can write something because you know the female mind, so to speak, and that you'll know what's going to upset somebody, you'll know what's going to make somebody fearful, you'll know what will make somebody recoil. You know, we're not stronger physically. We are the weaker sex in terms of physicality. We're aware of it from the time we're yay high. And it's just one of the things that we know in the back of our minds, so we know how to manipulate it to a certain extent.
Okay, now before I ask the three of you to speculate on whether Irish crime writers as a group could invade the international book markets, let's hear from some crime readers in Norway. Our own bookshelves have been effectively colonised by Scandinavian authors. But what is their secret? Ronan Kelly went to the Norwegian city of Bergen and asked a few local crime reading enthusiasts about why their particular brand of noir translates into massive international sales.
One reason Nordic noir is so popular down south is because it's popular up north too. For example, imagine you're off on your Easter holidays. What do you pack? Well, you might pack clothes, food, money. That's anywhere else in the world. But in Scandinavia, they pack one more thing, a pile of books.
There's this Easter tradition where you buy a lot of crime fiction before you go to your little cabin up in the mountains, and then you ski and you have your little orange and chocolate in the sun, and then you go inside and sit by the fireplace and read about horrible, horrible murders. Easter crime is a really common thing in Norway.
In my suitcase I have crime fiction from the beginning of the 50s by Stig Trenter, who was a very famous Swedish crime writer. And he was very, very popular.
Crime fiction is rampant north of the 55th parallel. And up there, Scandinavians are hardened crime readers.
I remember one of the books that Anne Holt wrote, that it was about a woman who was dead, and the door was opened and there was a dog that came into the flat and sort of licked the brains out of this woman. So it was ghastly, but wow!
I really like this Norwegian author, Jo Nesbø, which I think is absolutely fantastic. I think it's much better than the big Swedes.
Go into a bookshop in the land of the midnight sun, like this one in Bergen, Norway. And there's shelf after shelf of gruesome crime stories.
You can take the Swedish ones, Måns Kallentoft, Camilla Läckberg. You have the Danish one, Lotte og Søren.
Noor, the bookshop manager, reads the opening page of one.
Og det dette var en av disse. Selv satt jeg halvfull og småslumret bak skrivebordet mitt. The private detective heard a gunshot. Ikke lenge etterpå hørte jeg sirenen fra første politibilene. And I heard the sirens, and I was not sober when this happened, so he's a little bit drunk.
Are the Norwegians different from the other Scandinavians, or are they all of a type?
There is a similarity, so I can understand why they talk about the Scandinavian crime. You take a lot of the environment into the crime scenes and settings. I think it's inspired by the British crime.
But do you?
Yeah, because I think we've grown up with British crime on TV.
The Scandinavian writers may have learned from the British, but they've developed their own MOs by now.
I think the Scandinavian fiction is actually grittier. This is not like California in the 30s. I think it's kind of odd that you have this dark, gritty, kind of disturbing crime fiction emerging from the social democratic paradise.
I think there's a kind of a Sudoku or something that you have to find out who did it, and it's not so much the car chase and so on.
So it's intellectual?
Yeah, I think so. I hope so.
Look at Scandinavia. Law-abiding, decent people, fascinated with law-breaking nutjobs.
I guess maybe this because we're so nice. Maybe there is some sort of latent darkness in the Scandinavian society that just can emerge through crime fiction.
Maybe we are just bored, I don't know, and we need very much excitement because we are so peaceful normally. Sometimes I think of that because, for example, the snowman of Jo Nesbø is also full of horrific things. Everything is horrible, and you are deadly scared of snowmen for the rest of your life, especially if they're standing just outside your window. It's a sign you're going to be murdered and everything.
An older generation knew of the northern countries by their sleek design and social welfare. Now they're known for scary woods and police sweaters.
I want to see that we would have values of other things, you know. And this is a little bit destroying this. We're not so brutal as it seems that we are.
Does anybody say this is giving a bad image of Scandinavia?
I've never heard that. I think we are so small in the world that everything is good if someone knows something about us.
Not that I've heard of. I think just everybody's really proud. Any time we have an impact on the world, if it's through skiing or football or literature, it's like, yes.
Or Eurovision.
Oh yeah, and Eurovision definitely. It's a sort of musical crime, isn't it?
John Connolly, what do you think of this idea that has been put forward a few times, that what Irish crime writing needs is a dragon tattoo type of book, and suddenly there will be this thing, Irish crime writing, which can be sold as a product abroad?
I think the experience of other countries doesn't bear that out. what tends to happen is that one or two writers make the transition. There is a slight rising of the tide for other writers, but by and large, there isn't that much. So, you know, there hasn't been a huge influx of writers, French writers following Fred Vargas. There has not really been a vast number. While we're publishing a lot of Scandinavian crime fiction, some of it, to be perfectly honest, isn't very good because we've kind of run out of the really, really good stuff. And writers, say, like Arnold or Indrason in Iceland, are not driving Ferraris on the basis of the fact that people were buying Stieg Larsson books. Sometimes people just bought Stieg Larsson books. So I think, you know, we're probably due a breakout novelist. You know, probably Tana French is the one who's come closest, given that her books regularly feature on the New York Times bestseller list. And she is very much writing about Ireland. Hasn't really brought that many other writers writing about Ireland onto the New York Times bestseller list. And I think that's probably going to be the pattern. Even if we do have a breakout novelist, it'll be good for Irish crime fiction generally, because success of that kind will be good for crime fiction. And will make people more aware of it and make them realise there are other writers working in the same field. But they can't necessarily expect the same kind of sales because, like I said, the patterns in the market over the last 20 years would indicate that's not going to happen.
John, do you still believe that Irish readers are basically not comfortable with the whole notion of Irish crime fiction as a concept to begin with, even?
I just don't think they've been exposed to enough of it yet. I think it's very early days for us. And the writers who are writing it at the moment are kind of pioneers. They're pioneering figures. And they will have to take the knocks. You know, it will take time to build up this market. It will take time for people to be comfortable with seeing their society examined in this way through this particular genre. But, you know, the example on television of Love, Love, Hate is quite interesting. You know, I'm not sure that would have worked as a piece of fiction. But on television, people will accept it. You know, people will pick up non-fiction crime novels about gangs in Blanchardstown or Crumlin. They're not necessarily, don't necessarily want to read works of fiction about those same people. It's a slow, gradual process for us. But for the first time ever, we have a foundation. We have a generation of very, very talented novelists working in the area, going in all kinds of different directions, which differentiates us from the Scandinavians, Scandinavian novels tend to be quite similar. They tend to be fairly gloomy Scandinavian novels. The Irish crime writers have gone whizzing off in about 50 different directions. So over the next, what's going to be interesting is to see what happens over the next 10 or 20 years, to see how much of this actually beds down and to see what I think will happen, which is that gradually Irish readers will become accustomed to this and we will begin supporting our own writers in a way that we haven't done before. But I think because of the size of our country and the size of our market, more than the Scandinavians, more than the French or more than Americans, we will need to reach out beyond our shores and we will need to appeal to readers who are not Irish by birth.
My thanks to Alex Barkley, Arlene Hunt and John Connolly and indeed all the writers who have taken part in Irish Noir over the last few weeks, and thanks to you for listening.